This is a recording of the Michael Lerner teleconference with Commonweal on June 19th, 2006 at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Time.
He's the president of Commonweal and the co-founder of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. As I briefly mentioned, we have some useful resources available on the CHE website pertaining to the call, including the live web blog function and online resources relevant to today's topic. The live blog is available for call participants to post questions and comments during the call, and you don't need any special software other than a connection to the Internet. So to access the blog and the online resources, some of which have been given to us by the presenters, visit our website. It's www.healthandenvironment.org. On the left-hand side of your screen, you'll see a What's New box, and the very first item references today's call, and you click on that, and it will take you to the page of the reference materials and the blog. We are very pleased today to have on our call four presenters. We've got Dr. Pete Myers, the CEO of Environmental Health Sciences, who will be providing us with a science update. We have David Morris, the Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, Dr. Terry Collins, Thomas Lord Professor of Chemistry, and the Director, Thomas Lord Professor of Chemistry at Carnegie Mellon University at the Institute for Green Oxidation Chemistry, and Tracy Easthope, the Director of the Environmental Health Project at the Ecology Center. Before we begin, I'd like to cover some important logistical information regarding the call. Please note that everyone on the call, with the exception of our best guest speakers, will be placed in listen-only mode as soon as we're finished here. At the conclusion of the presentations, the operator will unmute all the lines so that you may participate in the question and answer period if you so choose. To be mindful of the process during the Q&A period, please identify yourself before you speak, and please keep your comment or question brief so that we can get in as many questions as we can. Please note that the call will last 1 hour. It is being recorded, and an audio MP3 file will be available on the CHE website for downloading within the next week or so. I would also note that next month's National Partnership call, we will be discussing diabetes and other metabolic disorders. The call is scheduled for Thursday, July 20th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, and we will be sending more information about this on the CHE listserv over the coming weeks. So, operator, if you could please...
Ms. Sotos, all lines are in listen-only mode.
Wonderful. Michael?
Thank you very much, Eleni, and welcome to all the CHE partners. I believe this is a very important call. Green chemistry is a tremendously promising and important development. So our first speaker, Pete Myers, on our science update. Pete?
Thank you, Michael. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm going to draw your attention to a paper that came out at the beginning of the month, published by Gail Prinz and Chuck Mayho, providing the strongest evidence to date that links exposure to bisphenol A at environmentally relevant levels to prostate cancer. This is work with rats. And I'm focusing on this today because I think it highlights the value of chemistry as it moves towards responding to signals from environmental toxicology and developing replacement molecules for services that we really need. Hopefully, we'll be able to have those molecules work for us and be designed in ways that don't interact with various cellular receptors. What Prinz and Ho did and their colleagues was they exposed neonatal rats to environmentally relevant doses of bisphenol A. They found that as the rats aged, as the exposed rats aged, they were much more likely than unexposed animals to develop a type of precancerous lesion in the prostate, something called a prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, or PIN. And the PIN lesions are considered to be the precursor of prostate cancer. 100% of rats treated neonatally with BPA developed PIN lesions, and most of these were high-grade cancers. Prinz and Ho then looked at changes in gene expression patterns that might provide insights into how this happened. After surveying a number of genes, they focused on one that controls the production of an enzyme called phosphodiesterase 4. Now, phosphodiesterase 4 breaks down cyclic AMP, a signaling molecule that regulates cell growth and differentiation. But they found that in normal animals, this gene becomes increasingly methylated or turned off as the animals age. So the production of phosphodiesterase 4 typically shuts down in older animals. But in exposed animals, animals exposed to bisphenol A, this methylation didn't take place. So the gene wasn't shut down. And so, in essence, it's changing how cell growth is being regulated. Really important result. Again, as I said, it's the strongest evidence to date providing links between environmentally relevant levels of bisphenol A and prostate cancer. And I certainly hope that the green chemists who are with us on this call and others are looking for replacements for bisphenol A, because this particular result is only one of many that have come out and highlighted the health risks that this molecule presents. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. And if any CHE partners are on this call and haven't yet discovered Above the Fold, the daily science summary from Environmental Health News, just go to environmentalhealthnews.org and sign up. Environmental Health News is CHE's information partner, and we're proud to collaborate with Environmental Health News in bringing first-rate science to the CHE community. And, of course, Environmental Health News goes far beyond that.
Michael, I should point out that there's a description of this paper and access to the original study at ourstolenfuture.org. Go to ourstolenfuture.org and click on newest, and you'll be taken to a paragraph and then through another click to a fuller description of it.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Pete. Our first speaker on green chemistry today it might be described as one of the real fathers of the field. David Morris is going to give us a broad view of the carbohydrate economy, issues of scale and ownership. David, you have 5 minutes. Please enlighten
Thanks,
us.
Thanks, Michael. I appreciate it. And let me make my points in staccato fashion, given the abbreviated time. The first is that anything that can be made out of a hydrocarbon can be made from a carbohydrate. That's a scientific fact. And in fact, in the past, we did so. Most of our chemicals and other materials were made from plant matter. The first plastic was made from cotton. The first thin film plastic was made from wood pulp. And as late as the late 1930s, a majority of plastics were derived from vegetables, not from minerals. The third point is that the carbohydrate economy disappeared after World War II for a number of reasons, but it revived beginning in the 1970s because of a combination of factors. One, of course, the higher prices of oil or mineral prices. The second were the biological advances, the green chemistry advances, if you will. And the third was the environmental regulations that began to internalize the real costs of using minerals and fossil fuels. In the biological advances, the first advances targeted the highest value markets, that is, highest value per pound or per ounce, which is, of course, the medical and pharmaceutical markets. But as they learned how to process and as the volume went up, they began to move through the learning curve. So, for example, in the 1980s, PLA, polylactic acid, was used for medical sutures, which would dissolve in the body, and they cost $200 a pound, which was fine given the cost of surgery. But then they learned how to make them cheaper and from different feedstocks, and today PLA is a commercial textile that costs less than a dollar a pound, so it's now increasingly a commodity plastic substitute. Fourth point is that there is sufficient amount of biomass grown in the world to displace all petrochemicals and all inorganic chemicals. But there is not enough biomass to displace a majority of liquid fuels for transportation or even a small portion of electricity. So we need to take that into account when we design public policy. The fifth point is that even though the biomass is not sufficient to replace a majority of your transportation fuels, even if they displaced 25%, it would have an enormous impact on agriculture, because it would mean that agriculture would be, and forestry would be, generating and harvesting more plant matter than is harvested today for all purposes, food and feed and paper and construction materials and the like. And that would have an impact, which is the sixth point, an impact on world trade. That is, we would have a profound change in world trade, with developing countries being able to grow plant matter for internal uses and not for external uses. And the next point is that because the carbohydrates are expensive to transport, they're very bulky, unlike oil, which can be transported long distances quite cheaply, then they would tend to be processed locally. And being processed locally, they could be farmer-owned and harvester and cultivator-owned. And so you could talk about a different structure of agriculture, ownership structure and scale structure, which would allow the value-added piece of the puzzle to be combined with the raw material production piece of the puzzle. And the final point is that the prospects look bright for an increased demand for biochemicals and biofuels, but the issue of ownership and scale and world trade, that is the agricultural related and rural development related issues, are not yet on the public policy table. They focused almost entirely on increasing demand. If people are interested in following up, we have a content rich website, newrules.org, and they can get more information on any of these topics.
David, thank you very much. That was a really brilliant, succinct summary. And I should mention, we should have mentioned it at the top of the call, that the American Prospect put out a very important issue on the green economy and green chemistry with pieces by David and Terry and Pete and others. I encourage you all to look at that. It may even be that Bob Kuttner is on the call, and if he is, I'm going to ask him to say hello when we start the questions. Our next speaker, Terry Collins, one of the founders and originators of Green Chemistry Work. Terry, your views, please.
Thank you, Michael. It's indeed a privilege to join you, Tracy, Pete, and David, to talk to other leaders about issues that are so central to the pursuit of a sustainable civilization. My great friend Paul Anastas defined the field of green chemistry as the design of chemical products and processes that reduce or eliminate the use and generation of hazardous substances. It's a very good definition. As he and another great friend, John Warner, have pointed out, the risk associated with any chemical depends on both its exposure function and its inherent hazard. Since the late 1690s, when lead oxide was eliminated as a wine-correcting agent in the German city of Ulm, we've dealt with comprehended chemical risks by regulating exposure. In modern times, we see an epitome of this in the repeated reduction of the maximum allowable daily exposure to benzene in the workplace. Green chemists propose, for the first time, to systematically focus on the hazard function of the risk equation. By redesigning chemical products and processes to minimize hazards, green chemists will bring about a strategic reorientation of the chemical technology base to align it with a sustainable future. Our field holds spectacular promise for helping to give our progeny a high-tech civilization free of the downsides with which this audience is so well acquainted. To deal properly with chemical hazards, chemists need to be knowledgeable about toxicity and ecotoxicity. Yet remarkably and almost universally, the amount of such training in a modern chemical education approach is nil, all the way to the PhD. This has to change, especially given the challenges of endocrine disruption, which Pete speaks so eloquently about, which mandates that the treasured beliefs of chemists on the benefits of chemistry to people have to be reevaluated. What, after all, is the value of a chemical product that is supposed to improve our life but is actually corrupting the chemical signals that control cellular development and compromising the health of developing things, including children, even to striking at the foundations of their humanity? While we green chemists are just starting our journey, our field has become global. Many of the functional attributes of a recognizable field are in place. There is a gratifying set of accomplishments, including my own group's contribution of Tamil activators, which solve a historic problem in chemistry by providing highly effective small molecule catalysts for activating one of nature's major oxidizing agents, hydrogen peroxide. Amyl activators represent a platform technology, and I think you'll hear much of them in years to come. By all measures currently applied, tamoxifen and their processes are non-toxic, but I would dearly love to see the prototype, which is progressing to commercialization, and its degradation products tested for endocrine disruption potential so I can tweak the prototype if need be. This also means I would love to see resolve the current impasse on what are going to be the legally binding tests for endocrine disruption. The first generation of green chemists will get only one chance to set the field up properly. We must not fail, or green chemistry will become irrelevant to sustainability. This requires us to think deeply about the challenges of different problem areas. In the first area, we find design for synthetic efficiency. Here, researchers improve reactions by making them more efficient, reducing waste and process toxicity. We're doing very well here, particularly in the pharmaceutical companies where large amounts of money are being saved through green chemistry. Everyone wins. In the second area, we find design for renewable feedstocks. As David has told you, this area is alive and well and can be expected to grow enormously because at long last it's become economic opportunity driven in agricultural states and regions worldwide. In a third area, we find design for solar technologies. We need more effort and support here, especially in university chemistry departments. But I'd like to point out that solar Stirling engines, a contribution from private entrepreneurs and engineering, look like they can provide the world with unlimited, cheap, clean electric power. I think with the advances David has elucidated, in addition, we probably already have the technology advanced to never need to build another coal, gas, or nuclear power plant. You can read about this at sterlingenergy.com. This moves me to close by considering three further problem areas that are going to be much more challenging to advance. In the first of these, we have design to replace toxic elements. Toxic elements, once mined, refined, and spread about through distributive technologies, are there in the environment to poison repeatedly. They are the prototypical persistent pollutants. For example, we need to stop feeding chickens arsenic compounds with all that this must mean, and to stop using an arsenic compound as a cotton defoliant. And we should be it would be a real advance to figure out how to replace mercury in those energy-efficient fluorescent light bulbs. In the second class, we have designed against persistent environmentally mobile compounds. Time and time again, we have learned that we cannot make and distribute persistent molecular compounds without running the risk of environmental mayhem. This is the source of the ozone hole. It's also the source of many, but by no means all, of our anthropogenic endocrine disruptors. It's hard enough in the present world to say, let's not make any more persistent environmentally mobile compounds for distributive technologies. But it's another matter altogether, because of economic complications, to work to find safe replacements for the ones we presently have. But we must find the courage to press on with this. Green chemistry has already achieved some great advances in protein-based pesticides that begin to show what is going to be possible. In the third area, we need to understand, we need to design against the entire class of endocrine disruptors. This will require us to understand endocrine disruption much better than we currently do. The work that is currently being done is brilliant, but we need much more of it. We must advance endocrine disruption research as critical knowledge for green chemistry, among many other things. At the end of the day, if green chemistry doesn't do big things to reduce the many threats to our children of anthropogenic endocrine disruptors, we will have failed in this historic time at what currently looks like our most important challenge. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry. A second really wonderful presentation. Our third very eminent speaker, a leader in the field of advocacy for environmental health, Tracy Easthope. Tracy, please give us your views.
Thank you, Michael, and thanks to Che for inviting me, and also thanks to David and Terry for their really important work. I'd like to provide some context for the work we've been doing in Michigan with a very specific example to advance green chemistry and green manufacturing, both to protect the environment and to increase our state's economic competitiveness. Michigan is ground zero for the structural readjustments in our economy due to globalization and the emerging information-based economy. Since 2001, Michigan lost 175,000 manufacturing jobs, one-fifth of its manufacturing base. Cities like Flint and Detroit are in the forefront of the nation's fifth-worst jobless rate, and the end isn't yet in sight. This isn't just happening in Michigan. The entire nation lost 13% of its manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. The economic base in Michigan is also supported by agriculture and tourism, the second and third largest sectors. Those sectors, the economic prosperity of those sectors, is dependent on the environment and the ecosystem services it provides. So the manufacturing sector needs to be compatible with any expected growth in these sectors. Another key to economic prosperity will be the remaking of the urban landscape in Rust Belt cities to attract the young workers who drive the information economy. This will require the transformation of the urban manufacturing base to be compatible with an emphasis on environmental amenities. The priorities of the major international markets are also driving change in the global economy. Progressive initiatives in Europe are demanding major reformulation of products to meet stricter environmental standards, and this trajectory is likely to continue as the costs of the old economy, including the cost of pollution, increased healthcare costs, loss of human and resource potential, continue to mount. In this changing landscape, it's a competitive and economic necessity to focus on job creation, resources in our region on technological advances that are as green as possible. The leadership in Michigan has identified four key areas of investment, including alternative energy, life sciences, homeland security, and advanced manufacturing, which includes emerging auto technologies. In each of these areas, environmental organizations have been advocating for the greenest technologies with the help of bio-based materials and green chemistry as an economic imperative. In addition, Michigan is the global automotive research and development center in the world and an important center for pharmaceutical research. So adoption of green chemistry can have a real impact in these major sectors. Given these realities and our assessment of the ripeness of green chemistry, several groups crafted a proposed executive directive for our governor to advance green chemistry. We're currently in discussions with the administration and businesses about this proposed approach, which has been favorably received. The directive would establish a green chemistry roundtable of key stakeholders to suggest areas where green chemistry could be employed to solve particularly important problems, and it would develop a green chemistry support program to promote and coordinate state green chemistry research, development, demonstration, education, and technology transfer activities. Some of the suggested initiatives include examining ways state government can create incentives for consideration use of green chemistry processes and products, and facilitate the adoption of green chemistry innovations. It would explore ways the state can promote the expansion of education and training of undergraduate and graduate students, as well as professional chemists and engineers. The directive prioritizes research to identify barriers to and methods to advance commercialization of green chemistry. The support program would also advance symposia and information sharing and introduce a Governor's Green Chemistry Award, and a copy of the full directive is on the CHE website. I want to note here that this is just one of the many initiatives in Michigan to further a carbohydrate economy. For environmentalists who've had a front row seat witnessing the human costs of our current toxic economy, advancing positive solutions to our material, agricultural, medical, and energy problems that are wise, green, just, and appropriately scaled are key priorities. But at least for now in our region, I think the need for economic competitiveness is likely to be the most powerful driver for green chemistry. Other states have similarly determined green chemistry is key to future growth and competitiveness, and I'll just give two examples. The six regional land-grant universities joined together in 2002 to form the New England Green Chemistry Consortium to build strategic partnerships and alliances with small and large businesses and state and federal governments. And their mission is to educate, discover, develop, apply, and promote green chemistry in all its forms, and thereby, quote, reduce the intrinsic hazards of the chemical enterprise. And then finally, a recent report authored by researchers at the University of California reviewed that state's current trajectory based on our toxic economy and concluded that that continued path would come at a great cost to California. It noted worldwide trends and concluded that California's competitiveness rested in part on its ability to adopt a green chemistry approach to manufacturing and growth. There are links to additional resources on green chemistry applications at the state and federal level and green chemistry products on the CHE website. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tracy. Wonderful presentation. Eleni, do you want to open the lines?
Yeah. So, Operator David, if you could please place everyone in talk and listen mode, that would be terrific.
All the lines are now open.
Wonderful. And I do have someone that has posted on the blog. David, you had mentioned a content-rich website. Folks are asking if you could mention what that is again.
Yes, it's our website, Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
Okay.
And it's newrules, one word, .org. And it contains the Basically, it's a website that contains actual policy language, legislative language in different sectors that has been passed at the state and local level, as well as sort of case studies.
Wonderful.
On different subjects.
Thank you. And also to note for folks who have access, Pete Myers and others have been posting some of these resources that they just spoke about. They're found both on the resources section of the website as well as in the blog. They're listed as well. So, Michael, would you like to initiate the Q&A?
Yes, and does Bob Kuttner happen to be on the line, the editor of the American Prospect? He was going to see if he could be on. Okay, very good. Let's go on. Please keep your questions concise, and please identify yourself. The lines are open.
Hello?
Yes?
Go ahead.
Hi, it's Leo Petrelli from Windsor. The question's for Tracy. I'd like to get your contact information because what's happening in Michigan is certainly happening in my community as a result of North American Free Trade Agreement. If we can get the transportation industry to start using green chemicals in their fuels, I think we're going to win on both sides of the river. So if you get a chance to give me your contact information, I'd appreciate it.
Tracy?
Sure. We can handle that offline.
Good.
Great.
Other comments and questions, please?
Marty Krasny from the Common Wheel Board. I'd be interested in hearing from any of you about the major impediments or oppositional forces and what you're doing, others can do, we can do to alleviate them.
David, why don't you take the first shot at that?
Well, sure. I mean, the obstacles is inertia, number one. I mean, sort of entrenched interests. But, I mean, part of that is, of course, political clout. But part of it is just that you have a sort of institutional entrenchment. And when it comes to developing new products, you not only have to manufacture the products, you have to distribute the products, you have to create the infrastructure. And so that requires a political will. I mean, the ethanol industry, there's a lot of people who say, well, you know, we shouldn't use corn. We should use some other feedstock. And, of course, ideally that's true. But people forget that in the late 1970s, when the federal government provided an incentive for ethanol, it made it competitive in the marketplace. But then to get into the marketplace, it had to be sold by its competitor. That is, it had to be sold by gas stations owned by oil companies. And then it had to be used in engines in car companies. And for 60 years, car and oil companies had worked together to perfect and optimize their engines for gasoline. So it took 10 years, and primarily it was done through Midwestern cooperatively owned gas stations and, of course, Midwestern farmers making it happen. So now we have an infrastructure and a distribution network, and we can move from there. In terms of the biochemicals and the like, a lot of that is driven by environmental regulations, which either internalize the cost of mineral-based chemicals or they actually outlaw them. And that has been the driving force on that side of the equation.
Terry, any quick comments on obstacles?
Yes, well, there is really no funding for green chemistry, or almost no funding for green chemistry research in the United States at the national level, despite the fact that other countries are investing in it enormously. That's a problem.
Right. Tracy, any comments?
I would agree. Our experience has been that people are really excited about figuring out how to advance green chemistry, but figuring out how best to do that has been the topic of some discussion. So I think there's tremendous excitement about moving forward.
If I could, Michael, just add that some of our public policy incentives, they're not perverse, but they're not ideal. For example, we have a biodiesel incentive for the use of vegetable oils in internal combustion engines. And that's a step in the right direction, but we don't have an incentive for the use of vegetable oils as a chemical and as a lubricant and for the higher value pieces of it. So what it does, in effect, is to guide ingenuity into the combustion field for vegetable oils rather than in the sort of pharmaceutical or other types of chemistries. So that's a public policy that was well-intentioned but poorly designed.
Michael, I'd like to ask, this is Eleni, I'd like to reflect a question on the blog. Margaret in Seattle has asked, have there been economic studies of the costs and cost savings of conversion to green chemistry?
Comments?
If people would go up to our website, this is newrules.org, we did a study for the Great Lakes Pollution Group on converting from petrochemicals to biochemicals there. And part of it was an economic analysis of what the comparative costs are when you do a full cost accounting, including the disposal costs, so people can download that and read that. And if they can't, then just contact me.
And how would you summarize the findings for those of us who won't get that far?
The findings are that the green chemicals are more expensive as a first cost, but increasingly they're less expensive over a life cycle cost, which includes the cost of disposal and the cost of handling. And the marketplace doesn't quite recognize that, but corporations increasingly do recognize that. For example, the use of vegetable oils for substitute for mineral oils in printing operations reduces the health exposure of the printers themselves, and that industry, especially that unionized part of the industry, takes that very much into account. So that is the essence of it.
David, just to ask quickly, this is Charlotte Brody. What's the name of that report? I'm on the website, and it's not.
Oh, well, then contact me through the website. It's called, we did it about 10 years ago, and it's something to the effect of replacing petrochemicals with biochemicals, a case study of the Great Lakes region. But, if not, people can contact me through the website or dmorris, D-M-O-R-R-I-S, at I-L-S-R, Institute for Local Self-Reliance.org.
Well, this is Pete Myers. I'd like to add something to this discussion. Specifically, while what David said is certainly true overall, if one looks from 30,000 feet to the cost of green chemicals, in fact, industry is already finding that within specific processes for specific products, there are cost advantages immediately to switching to certain types of green chemical procedures and processes. So, to do the switch wholesale, yes, there are things that can be more expensive at the outset. But already, industry, in certain sectors of the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, for example, are finding ways to save money today by switching to these new procedures.
And let me just add to that, this is Tracy, that Pfizer has up on their website some stunning case studies of the cost savings they've been able to achieve. It's in part because of the particular business where there's so much waste per product, but they've just been saving incredible amounts of money, and that's been driving their green chemistry efforts in part.
And you can find additional descriptions of this at the Green Chemistry Institute's website. If you Google Green Chemistry Institute, you'll find it, and I'll post the direct link in the blog.
There's two additional case examples, although I don't think they've become published case studies. One is at the University of Minnesota. The janitors, of course, led the way in terms of displacing their cleaning materials with biological materials. And at the Beltsville, Maryland Department of Agriculture, Agricultural Research Station, they did a comprehensive displacement of petrochemicals by biochemicals, and in those two places it was the maintenance, the janitorial, the cleaning crews that led the way, as one would expect.
That's brilliant.
And Michael, let me just add, this is Eleni. Most of these resources, the Green Chemistry Institute and the executive order that Tracy Easthope mentions and so forth, are all listed on the background information and resources section. If you go to the What's New page, the home page under the What's New box, there's a link to today's call, and then there's a link to background information and resources. But most of these websites are listed. If you go to the bottom, there's useful links as well that were talked about. Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? This is Ted Shetler. As is inevitable in these kinds of conversations, we've had mention of green chemistry and also bio-based plastics and other materials, and David mentioned fuel. And, of course, this is all in the background of using biological materials for food, both for human and animal consumption. So I have a question and concern about the extent to which we are now moving in a direction where we've got a lot of competing interests beginning to mine the surface of the earth for surface-based biological materials, plant-based materials, to replace petroleum for all of the reasons that have been stated. But who's looking out for the big picture where we'll continue to believe, if we're not careful, that we can simply replace our wasteful material economy based on petroleum with the same economy based on plants, unless we look with, you know, with rather you know, a fairly strict view of our, or a careful view of what we're actually hoping to do with these materials, without thinking about the total impact on biological diversity, soil quality, and so forth. Responses?
Well, I think that's a really good question. One point, I mean, I think it's going to evolve, and we're going to have to work it out in real time. I don't think you can divine every aspect of it, although careful planning is a good idea. But let me point out that the planet receives an enormous amount of solar energy on a daily basis, and in fact, the technology areas that are working on generating electrical energy directly from solar to electrical, this looks like a new addition as opposed to a repartitioning of any particular pie. This looks like a new pie that we have to work with, and I think that if you add that to the whole mix, we're going to be in really good shape.
Well, if I could, Ted, it is a good question, and it's not one that's being avoided by a lot of people. It is a key question, and when I said in my presentation that we could, with the current feedstock, without any problem whatsoever in terms of volume, replace all inorganic and organic chemicals with biochemicals, that's not a problem of supply. When it comes to liquid fuels, and 70% of our liquid petroleum is used for transportation purposes, there you cannot, in fact, displace a majority. You can displace a minority before you run into a food versus fuel issue. And when it comes to electrical generation, we shouldn't even pretend to be using biological materials, that is, plant matter or stored energy, for electrical generation. And once again, on the website, I only keep pointing people to our website because everything we know we put up there is something called A Better Way, which is a report that I did that argues that when it comes to transportation, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles with a flexible fueled engine is the way to go, because then the majority propulsion is electricity, and you can get an enormous amount of electricity from renewable energy like wind, and then the minority becomes the backup engine, and with the reduction in the engine fuel that you need, a dramatic reduction, you then can in fact talk about biofuels as a replacement for oil on the engine. So it is a very important issue, and sometimes the public policy does not take into account that, and they sometimes provide incentives that perversely take land and they focus it on energy rather than food or feed.
Other questions, please.
Michael, I'd like to reflect a question from Dr. Clinton Boyd of the Sustainable Research Group in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He asks a question for Dr. Terry Collins. To what extent has green chemistry addressed the halogenation of synthetic compounds?
Not very much. The chemical activators that I described to you are actually provide a replacement for the use of chlorine in certain oxidation processes in solution, which I think is going to be a really good thing. What's been happening in the world of chlorine is that we are increasing worldwide production of chlorine, not reducing it. So about 10 years ago, it was about 35 million tons a year. Now it's about 45 million tons a year. Most of it's going into PVC. The ultimate fate, I think, of PVC in terms of it burning is going to be producing dioxin. So it's a real issue. It's something that I think is going to require regulatory handling rather than anything else.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question myself. I'd like some of the speakers to address the geopolitical and national security consequences of moving from a feedstock that exists, oil, in a few very challenging parts of the world, to a feedstock that can be grown in every congressional district in the United States, and as David suggested, very often be processed by locally owned businesses and so forth. To what degree Now I'm recognizing that that biofuels and biomaterials are not going to replace electricity or and only perhaps 25% of fuel. But to what degree has anybody looked at, seriously, to what degree the geopolitical system and the national political system would be changed if we move toward a green economy and green chemistry in those senses? Is there any serious analysis of the consequences?
Well, there's sort of several layers of that issue. I just came back from addressing a world conference in Sweden. Wonderful people there as speakers, and you know, there's the north-south developing country, developed country issue, and there increasingly the developing countries, it's the southern hemisphere countries, are looking at biofuels in a very ambitious way, led by Brazil. About India and Asian countries, and for them, you know, this is a wonderful opportunity for them to reduce their need for hard currency, for imported oil, internal development, and the like. So that is a very clear and very important thing. Internal to the developed countries, you know, there is the issue of ownership and the issue of scale, which, as I indicated, is not on the public policy sector. The reason that the ethanol is now on everybody's front page and front burner is that they're building them everywhere, and so there's now a very big political constituency. But it isn't, although I indicated that you could have farmer ownership and you could have rural manufacturing facilities that really did, were rooted in both a literal and a figurative sense of the word, things are changing very rapidly now. 80% of all new ethanol plants that were built in 2002 were majority farmer-owned. 80% of all the ethanol plants that are being built today are absentee-owned, mostly by Wall Street, not by the big grain companies. And so you're actually moving away. You sort of move through the period of local ownership, and that is something, the same thing is happening in Brazil, the same thing is happening in Asia, and people are trying to figure out what to do about that, but the overall focus is on increasing supply rather than ownership issues.
Other questions, please?
I just wanted to add one thing about security and chemicals and just remind people of the debate going on in the Congress right now around chemical security and our nation's chemical plants may be targets. So there's been a lot of discussion about reducing chemical threats, and certainly green chemistry is an important role to play there.
In other words, Tracy, it's a lot less dangerous to have a green chemistry fuel plant than a chemical plant. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in high population centers, that's really critical.
Thank you. Very important point. Other questions?
Hi, this is Sandra Steingraber in Boston. I'm here at a breast cancer meeting, and I'm on a speakerphone. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. I guess this might be for Terry or whoever else could answer it. I actually grew up right downwind from one of the world's largest ethanol distilleries in central Illinois, which, you know, in Illinois we have a lot of these things because this prairie, it took a while to get sod busted, and when it did, there still were no train tracks. So to ship corn back east, we turned it into whiskey. It was kind of a value-added thing. And then after World War II, all those whiskey distilleries were turned into ethanol facilities. They're among our state's biggest polluters, and they right now rely on tremendous amounts of benzene, which are released in great quantities into both air and water. And I'm wondering, even were we to switch over to ethanol as a biofuel, can the actual manufacturing process be greened up?
A couple of answers to that, if I may, and it was something I was going to say before, is that you can make, this was in our report to Great Lakes, you can make an identical chemical from biomass, which saves a great deal of pollution, but can be made in a chemical-intensive way, which is not all that favorable to the environment, although much better than the chemical. And in other words, you can make ethylene and polyethylene starting from ethanol, but you can also use an enzymatic biological process to make the biological product, the bioproduct, if you will. And that's really what ethanol plants do for the most part. And so the pollution doesn't come from the, you know, from the actual distillation or fermentation of the you know, of the ethanol itself. There are thermal oxidizers that are now required for ethanol plants, and so they really should be, you know, virtually non-polluting. There's an odor that's attached to them, which is the odor of drying, not the odor of ethanol, but the odor of drying, drying the corn. In terms of benzene, there's a, it's a holdover from the Prohibition era in the 1920s, where we outlawed constitutionally beverage alcohol, but we didn't outlaw industrial alcohol. And so to get a permit to make alcohol, you had to denature it, which was your final little process, your final step in the production process. You had to put 3 to 5% of basically gasoline additives or gasoline components into the ethanol, and that's true today. So ethanol, now in Brazil, 100% ethanol is 100% ethanol. You could actually drink it, but in the United States you can't, and that's where those chemicals come from. That you know, so if we allowed an ethanol plant to produce straight vodka, or, you know, 200 proof vodka, which is just fine for the gasoline engine and everything, then we would avoid some of those problems.
Thank you. Was that David?
Yeah.
Terry, that was also addressed to you.
Yes, thank you, Michael. Senator, it's a very good question, and it brings to mind the idea of procedures. What one does is you take a look at the problem and then use your chemical understanding and intuition to find ways around the problem in all cases. So green chemistry, its move towards sustainability, is literally about tens of thousands of inventions solving problems of the kind that you've talked about, although from what David has said, it might be much easier to solve than perhaps we would think. I would like to point out that Camel activators, the catalyst that we produce, will activate hydrogen peroxide and water. You use a tiny amount of the catalyst, a little bit of hydrogen peroxide, and you can decolorize and reduce organic chlorines in the effluent from the pulp and paper industry. You can decolorize all of the commercial dyes that are used in, or nearly all the commercial dyes that are used by the textile industry. And you can also remarkably decompose pharmaceuticals in trace quantities in water. And this is actually, this last thing I think is really quite important, because it's another way to think about greening. Rather than, you know, we need the pharmaceuticals to work for the health problems that we have as they currently are. But if we can chase them out of our water treatment plants in a final stage treatment, that would be a remarkable thing. And I actually think that it's entirely possible and reasonable to expect from what we're seeing in the lab that is doable. So there's lots of things that we can do on effluent streams, particularly in water with Tamil activators, that are going to make a big difference, is just a general comment.
Other questions? Here's another question that hasn't come up yet. One reads in the business pages and so forth a great deal about chemical companies beginning to pursue these green chemistry things. And so the question I have is, are there criteria for what is green chemistry that we need to put in place so that the term isn't diluted and applied to things that are not good for humans and ecosystems? In other words, is what we're reading about as advances in green chemistry in the business pages really advances, or is there a competition for the meaning of the term, and are there concerns we need to address there?
Well, I'd say that there are definitely concerns. I mean, we held back, and this is David again. About 15 years ago, we had the first worldwide meeting in Annapolis that the NCC hosted on a definition of compostable when it came to bioplastics at that time, and it was astonishing how people in Germany defined degradable. You know, different from Japan, different from the United States. They all had different standards. And so these standards are something that we really need to look at. The federal government by law has required Congress has required the executive branch to have bioproducts as a preferable product, as an environmentally preferable product, and they've spent 4 years going through what the standards might be around that, and they just came up with the final standards just a couple of months ago. So in certain categories, and as part part of the standard process. They have to go through an evaluation on the life cycle analysis of it so there is a there's an interesting. I'm not sure what I think about it. It certainly isn't bad, but it may not be ideal, and people might want to take a look at the evaluative process that the federal government has now put into place to analyze the comparative benefits of bioproducts that they buy.
Tracy or Terry, do you have comments on the standards issue?
Tracy?
Well, I was going to say, Terry, I'd really be interested to hear your
No, I mean, Michael, it's an absolutely outstanding point. In fact, as I said in my talk, we really are only going to get one chance to do it right. And that is part of the reason why I kept my focus on the highest order problem, which is endocrine disruption. We have watched in the last 15 years as green chemistry has grown, many researchers coming and saying, look, I've got this wonderful green chemistry technology, but part of it's green and part of it is not. And so in all cases, you have to take a very hard look at the meaning of green. That's my reason. I have the same problem with thermal activators. I don't know that they're not endocrine disruptors. I don't know that their degradation products are not endocrine disruptors. It's likely that they're not, but I certainly would like to know for sure. And I think that keeping your mind constantly on that particular problem, as well as another high priority problems, and asking these really, really hard questions of the technologies as they come along is going to be an absolutely critical thing to do to make sure that we don't start moving off track in terms of getting the directionality right for producing a sustainable civilization.
Tracy, would you like to add to that?
I was going to add that from an advocate's perspective, I think, Michael, you've hit on one of the most difficult things that we need to really grapple with, and that is how do we define something that essentially is a process towards a goal, and how do we decide what we'll call green chemistry and not, and who decides? And I think we're still in the midst of figuring that out.
Pete Myers, would you like to comment on that? Lost Pete.
Michael, this is Eleni. I have a...
No, actually, I had to turn on my mic. I had it on.
Yeah.
These observations have been exactly to the point, and it's a struggle that the community faces constantly, and we will not get away from it. I think what we need to be able to do is to ensure there are places like the Aries Institute at Carnegie Mellon, John Warner's at the University of Massachusetts Fall, the Green Chemistry Institute, who are constantly watchdogging and challenging people who aren't getting it right. Incredibly important function. The challenge is it's also technically quite difficult, and so we need to have these places on that sort of safeguarding.
Thank you.
And if I might just add one point, I mean, you know, something you might develop something and think it's just incredibly green, and then in the light of new knowledge that might come along a few years later, suddenly realize it isn't. Part of the process is having the courage to back away from highly non-sustainable technologies when they come up. And this is also a tremendous challenge, obviously, for the chemical industry to deal with, because we're dealing with corporate leaders who, in many cases, wake up one morning and find out that the principal component of their profit base suddenly has this terrible problem that they never dreamed was there when they first developed the technology. And we need to be sympathetic to their plight, but we also need to press on with doing something about it.
You know, I'll add one additional thing, which is that I think the work that's been done around the precautionary principle and some of the ways to engage precaution when introducing new compounds and technologies could be quite helpful, including monitoring and bonding and all sorts of things when we're thinking about these new technologies. So I think that might offer us some help when thinking through this.
Thank you very much. Eleni, you were going to comment.
We have a question from Gabriella Silvani from the EMS Science Communication Network. The question is, inertia was noted as an impediment for green chemistry. How is green chemistry viewed within academia and senior scientists? Perhaps Terry might want to take that.
Yeah.
I think it started off with people. You need to understand a little thing, something about chemistry. Usually new fields, chemistry is very conservative. Science is very conservative. It's probably not inappropriate at all that it be conservative. And so what happens is fields come along and people say, no, you know. And then after a period of time, people begin warming up to them. I think with green chemistry, we definitely have the challenge of becoming fully embraced, if you like, by the entire academic group. But it'll happen. And I've no doubt it'll happen. And that is because of the quality of the work that we are producing when you get down and look at it. And so one of the key things in building a field is to have the highest levels of scientific excellence, and this is happening in green chemistry to a very significant degree, and it's going to mean that we are going to have a much easier time as time goes on of becoming fully integrated. We are really challenging them. I mean, I can't tell you how difficult it is to consider integrating toxicity and ecotoxicity information into the fundamental chemical pedagogy when you've spent your life not doing that. We don't have the professors themselves need to be trained, and so we're working behind the scenes to try to figure out ways to help that transformation occur.
Thank you very much. We're getting toward the end. Eleni, do we have time for...
We have time for one quick question.
One quick question. Anybody online have a question that hasn't been asked yet?
We do have one comment from Daryl Ditz at the Center for International Environmental Law. And he basically said, it seems that one enormous policy obstacle to the blooming of green chemistry is the fact that there is no legal obligation on U.S. chemical manufacturers to discover or publicize the hazards of their products. And I don't know if we want some final comments on that. Comment.
Yeah, that's a good last point. Any thoughts or comments on that?
Totally true.
I was going to say, absolutely agree. It's just absolutely critical to drive these changes.
It seems to me that of the many really, I mean, I think it's been an extraordinary conversation, and each of the presentations and the dialogue was really, really outstanding in terms of how substantive it was. This point about standards, the challenges they create, the process issues that Tracy pointed out to, how do you create standards when it's an ongoing process that Terry and David both addressed, seems to me that it's an issue that the collaborative might continue to think about. What would happen if there was an international effort by concerned scientists, patient and health professional advocates, citizens, and others that could be created as a consensus document and brought into various policy processes. Is that happening, and would that be a good idea?
Well, I think in part it's happening, mostly in Europe rather than the United States, but I'm sure that people on the line have been part of that discussion. I mean, you had your International Standards Organization for Sustainable Manufacturing, that went through a very interesting process that took a number of years and is now adopted. And there's a number of sustainability, standards groups that are at work with that. But they're primarily focused, because Europe is ahead of us in a regulatory fashion. They're primarily focused on Europe, but we could certainly piggyback on their work. Mm-hmm.
If I can make just a little comment, green chemistry is about integrating a whole range of relevant other information into chemistry that's not currently there. And so this think tank, I think, is what you're really talking about, Michael, that you're speaking of, has to be a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something quite different from, say, the REACH effort in Europe, what you're talking about.
Yes.
It just has to be a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Tracy, any last comments from you?
I very much like this suggestion you've made, and I'd like us to pursue it. I know that there are various efforts, as David suggested, but I think that there still may be a role for that kind of work. So I'd be interested in pursuing that.
Well, thanks to all four speakers for a really outstanding partner call. Eleni, I'm turning it back to you.
Yes, I just want to quickly mention that next month's call is going to focus on diabetes and other metabolic disorders. It's scheduled for July 20th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, and we will be sending out more information in the next couple of weeks. I also want to thank our presenters for an outstanding call today, and we look forward to talking with all of you next month. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.